the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Well, last year, unbeknownst to many people, Congress made major changes to Social Security. They may change the amount of benefits that you get over your lifetime. What does all this mean for your retirement? Joining me on the program is Professor Wade Fow from American College. And Professor, let's begin with some of the changes because, I mean, those were some pretty big changes and there wasn't a lot of discussion about it before those changes were made.
Right. Yeah. Late last year, the Congress enacted some new proposals regarding some provisions that were created in the year 2000 that allowed for filing and suspending and different things. This will affect a limited number of people, but it became a really popular strategy to discuss in the popular culture. And last year, Larry Kotlikoff had, I think, the number 3 best-selling book on all of Amazon about Social Security claiming strategies. And he basically began the first chapter of his book with the strategy that's now being phased out. And that's, some people who are going to use it and would have high Social Security benefits could potentially get up to around $50,000 of additional benefits that they'll no longer be able to receive. The idea was the higher earning spouse would file for their Social Security benefit at their full retirement age and suspend receiving it until age 70 so that they get those additional credits for delaying Social Security. But at the same time, their spouse could file a restricted application and receive 4 years of the spousal benefit while their spouse's benefit had been suspended. And that's not going to be possible anymore for people. There's a few different things going on. I think for the most part, for people reaching the full retirement age after May 1st, 2016.
Yeah, and we might want to point out those strategies are still available. I think, isn't it, doctor, if you are 65 and a half or 66 right now?
Right. So they're still available right now. You have to reach 66 by, I think, May 1st of this year.
Now, when Social Security benefits were put into place and some of the modifications, you know, there has always been this debate, should I take it at age 62 when you can first get it or delay the benefits to age 70? Now, it used to be a much easier call to make. Number one, when Social Security was first put into effect, people didn't live as long. And certainly, if you look at over the last half century, interest rates were much higher than where they are today. So in those days, you know, it was pretty clear if you delayed claiming, if it was possible, especially for singles or let's say a higher earning spouse, in many cases, the husband, it made a lot of sense. Let's talk about now that we no longer have file and suspend and file and restrict, what about the benefits of delaying Social Security? Because we know that, for example, after full retirement age of 66 or 67, if you delay until age 70, those benefits go up 8% a year. Who does that strategy benefit today? In other words, where would that strategy be appropriate?
Well, that strategy is something that continues to get better with each passing year. Now, one of the extra icings on the cake for doing that is now being phased out, but it doesn't overturn the general idea of delaying Social Security. The 8% credit increase as you delay towards 70, that was developed in 1983. Interest rates were a lot higher at the time. People were not living as long. And that was meant to be, quote unquote, actuarially fair, that it really shouldn't matter what age you claim Social Security. If you delay, you would miss out on the benefits for the years you're delaying, but then you get a higher benefit subsequently to offset that, so that if you live to your life expectancy, you should just break even. But since 1983, as people are living longer and as interest rates have come down, I mean, the Social Security actuaries used a 2.9% real return assumption. And now today, if you look at TIPS, that's where you see the real interest rates. They're much lower. They're even under 1%. So you're basically, by delaying Social Security, you're getting a much higher real return on a quote-unquote asset of your future Social Security benefits than if you were to claim early. So the case for delaying Social Security really has become stronger because it's more thinking about Social Security as insurance. It's longevity protection. It protects against market risk. It's an inflation-adjusted benefit. and it lasts for as long as someone lives. And you do better if you make it past approximately age 80. But I always say, you know, the concern is, what if you don't live to age 80? What if you delay Social Security to 70 and then die at 75? Well, of course, in hindsight, it would have been better to claim earlier. But at the same time, because you unfortunately didn't live as long, your retirement was not as expensive. It's unfortunate, and you could have been better by claiming earlier. But the concern that people should really have is, what if I live to 100? How can I afford that? And that's where you can improve your lifetime standard of living significantly by delaying Social Security. And I really think that's where the focus should be, on protecting oneself over a long lifetime rather than planning for a short retirement that's not going to be very expensive anyway.
You know, one of the things that really strikes me, too, we know, for example, if, let's say, full retirement age is 66, and you delay taking those benefits to age 70, the government is going to increase that benefit at 8% a year. Professor, I don't know any place in the marketplace today where I could get a guaranteed 8% return a year or increase for at least a four-year period. I couldn't even get that in a small, let's say, intermediate bond.
Right. And it is important to make clear, because this can be a confusing issue for people, that you're not really getting an 8% return. It's just that your benefits increase by 8% for each year of delay. To know what the return you get on delaying Social Security requires knowing your age of death, because it requires calculating an internal rate of return where the payment you're making is the lost benefits for each year that you delay. And then the benefit of doing that is then the subsequent increase in benefits after that later year where you start your benefits, and can get up to close to 8% if you live, it depends on a few assumptions, but if you live somewhere in the ballpark of 95 to 100, you could be looking at an 8% real return on the internal rate of return on delaying your Social Security. If you don't live that long, the internal rate of return is less. But nonetheless, it's definitely important to think about, and it is important to be clear that it's not that you're getting an 8% return automatically by delaying Social Security, because this issue, it depends on how long you live.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, obviously, if you don't live to, I think, what did you say, the break-even is around age 80?
Yeah, in the early 80s, somewhere around. It depends on what discount rate you use as well, but with interest rates, real interest rates being so close to zero, if you assume zero, basically the break-even age is age 80.
Now, you've given an example of a couple that could claim Social Security benefits at age 62. The benefit would be roughly $2,500 a month. Since they're taking it at age 62, that would be reduced by 25% or $1,875, versus allowing that benefit to go to age 70, which that monthly benefit would grow to almost $800 a month more. You've given an example of a drawdown from a portfolio in the early years and then less of a drawdown in the later years because the benefit is made up primarily from an increase in Social Security benefits. Let's talk about that, because the withdrawal rate actually declines. And isn't that one of the real risks that retirees are running today? Because there's two influences that have come in here that have altered retirement income. One, we're living in a period of unusually low interest rates. We've never seen something like this in half a century. And number two, people are living much longer.
Yeah. And so delaying Social Security is giving you, it depends how long you live, but if you make it to life expectancy, it's giving you a 2.9% real return. And that's really attractive compared to other alternatives. And so that's where, if you set up a problem where if you're 62 years old and you delay to 70, you do have the issue that for that eight-year period, you're going to have to take more out of your portfolio. And if you just leave that all in a volatile investment portfolio, you are more exposed to sequence of returns risk. But I created some examples that just assume you carve out those 8 years of missing age 62 benefits from your overall portfolio and set that aside and not really expose it to market volatility. Just do something much safer, either some sort of CD ladder or a fixed term annuity or an 8-year bond ladder, something that's not going to be exposed to volatility. And then just set that aside, and now you have whatever is left in your portfolio. Well, you can then basically glide through lifetime, considering at age 70, you now get a much higher, 76% higher Social Security benefit that will reduce the overall withdrawal rate you have to use on your investment portfolio throughout your retirement. which this is meeting a particular spending goal. So if you're able to meet your spending goal with a smaller withdrawal rate, you're improving the chance for your retirement success. And again, that's possible just because Social Security delay provides such a high, safe internal rate of return.
Professor, who would this apply to? I can think of several cases. For example, a lot of executives or individuals that work for corporations, many of them, especially I've seen this in the oil industry, the big oil companies, they'll have something like a deferred comp program for their executives. And so that deferred comp is paid out over a 10-year period, 5-year period. It seems like delaying Social Security benefits is an ideal strategy for those kind of individuals. And another area that I've seen work out real well is where an individual will take a certain amount of their portfolio and create their own private pension by, let's say, an immediate annuity. I know you've done a number of studies on bond portfolios, stock portfolios in terms of drawdowns over life expectancies, and you have found the combination of annuities and, let's say, dividend-paying stocks or dividend-paying mutual funds to be a worthwhile strategy that plays out well over the long term.
That's right. Yeah, the income annuities basically can serve as somewhat of a replacement for the bond funds because they're providing bond-like returns and also provide that longevity protection that the bond fund is not able to provide. And that being said, Social Security is an income annuity, and in particular, it's a CPI-adjusted income annuity. And really, the first step of moving in the direction of purchasing an income annuity, it would be pretty inefficient to start Social Security at age 62 and then to buy an income annuity. That basically the best deal you can get on income annuities is to delay Social Security. You get a much higher implied payout rate from doing that, where you think of the premium for the annuity is your 8 years of lost benefits, and then the payout from the annuity is that 76% increase in benefits starting at age 70. The implied payout rate from doing that, it's better than any commercial annuity. But they both tie in very well together, that I do think income annuities can play a very valuable role in a retirement income plan. And basically, Social Security is the best example of an income annuity, better than any commercially available version.
You know, Professor, at one time, companies, many corporations in this country offered what was called a defined benefit pension plan, which the government still does. And what they didn't realize is those defined benefit pension plans were really income annuities. The company would go to some insurance company and they say, you know, Joe worked at the company for 30 years. This is a pile of money that we put aside for him. What kind of income will that provide for Joe and his wife, or just Joe alone, depending on what his options were? That's basically what defined benefit plans are, the way they used to work. When you are taking an immediate annuity, you're almost doing the same thing. And the reason I want to bring this up is for the longest period of time, when returns were much higher, let's say in the stock market, because valuations were lower, interest rates were much higher than where they are today, the standard strategy for many individuals is when they retired, they rolled over their 401k program into, let's say, an IRA rollover, and whatever they would earn, they would take a withdrawal. And today, some of those companies offer annuity options that are actually much better. The reason I bring this up is we're working on a case right now where the annuity options for this couple, for this individual that worked for this company, are much more attractive than what we could get in the marketplace, let's say trying to get income from bonds or even where the stock market is.
Right. I've seen a lot of examples of that as well, where the defined benefit pension, someone's looking at the alternative between taking a lump sum or receiving an income for life. And if you look at the income for life and you look at the lump sum payment, it implies payout rates that, again, often do exceed the payout rates. You'd be much better off taking the lifetime income from the pension than you would be by taking the lump sum and then using that to go buy an annuity. And so, yeah, it can be a very attractive type of proposition. The defined benefit pensions are essentially income annuities. The reason we've had trouble with them is not anything to do with their guaranteed income side. It's just been this tendency that people ignore what the actuaries are saying. And it, no matter whether it's the government or a private business, the current leadership is always more willing to increase the benefits in an unsustainable way because they know those promises are only going to be paid well off into the future when the current management has already retired or is otherwise no longer working, or it's a politician making the decision who will no longer be around at the time the bills come due. So the defined benefit pension pools longevity risk among all the workers, and it pools market risk by providing a defined benefit amount based on years of service and salary, not based on any sort of investment growth for an underlying individual account. And so workers could benefit from that. They didn't have to bear that market risk on their own, and they don't have to bear the longevity risk. They're pooling that with all their fellow workers from different birth cohorts and from within the same retirement cohort.
Why do you think annuities have gotten such a bad rap? I mean, there's even commercials on television warning people about annuities that they're bad investments, where basically, as we just described here, most people that are getting a steady pension, whether it's a government pension or a corporate pension, essentially what they're getting is an annuity.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons for that. One is that basically the kinds of annuities I've been talking about thus far represent about 4% of the overall annuity market. Income annuities or immediate annuities are a very small piece of the overall market. There's much more complicated annuities, whether they're indexed or variable annuities, different types of annuities that they're much more complicated to understand. They have much higher commissions built in and so forth. And it's really those are the annuities that are creating the bad reputations, but they're 96% of the market. So they're the ones that kind of overwhelm the overall discussion. But also, I think it's the financial services industry is kind of divided between the investment side and the insurance side. The insurance side generally thinks everything can be solved with insurance, but the investment side generally thinks everything can be solved with investments. I don't know how many times I've seen like calculators on the market about how much you can save for retirement and so forth that just assume you're going to get an 8% compounded return. And markets are volatile, and I think on the investment side, sometimes there's not enough credit for what annuities can do just because there's this implicit assumption that you're always going to get, well, if you're guaranteed to get yourself an 8% investment return on your portfolio, then yeah, you're going to be better off than with an annuity. But if markets don't cooperate, and when you're retired and you're exposed to that sequence risk where market returns early in retirement matter so much more, so disproportionately in what the overall outcome is going to be, then it's not clear you're going to get the kind of return necessary to beat out what an income annuity would be able to guarantee for you. So I think that's the other side of the puzzle as well. It's just the income annuities are a small part of the market, and then the investment side, and as well with a fee-only investment management firm, they don't make money by selling financial products like annuities. They make money by having as big of investment portfolios for their clients as possible. And so any money that leaves that portfolio and goes into an annuity, the investment management company can no longer bill for that. And so their financial incentive is to keep everything in the investment portfolio.
Let's talk about also some of the tax implications of delaying Social Security benefits, because a lot of times, you know, when a person leaves the workforce, they're going to be in a lower tax bracket. Number one, they're not paying Social Security taxes anymore. And some of the benefits of, let's say, using part of your portfolio, whether you create an immediate annuity or you're drawing it down and delaying the benefits, but there's some tax savings that are involved in here as well that might work to the advantage of a retired person.
Yeah, I think especially for the middle class, if you combine delaying Social Security with a program of Roth conversions, you can reduce your overall lifetime tax bill. Because as you're saying, and assuming you've retired, so that if you say retire at 62, so you no longer have labor income or earnings from the workforce, then that really changes your tax picture. Now your taxes are going to be paid on capital gains on your investments, on any distributions from your tax deferred accounts and so forth. You don't have to pay taxes on anything taken out of the Roth. So you can have that opportunity to set up, move assets from your IRA into your Roth IRA, pay taxes between those ages of 62 and 70, when you may be, for a while, 0% tax rate, but then 10% tax rate, and then 15% tax rate. Manage those brackets. And it depends. It's where middle class folks might be able to manage that 15% tax bracket and better stay out of the 25% tax bracket. And that can provide a way to lower their overall lifetime taxes. Because you also have to remember that Social Security income is taxable, not in the same way as regular earnings, but there's a series of complicated steps. It's not just the adjusted gross income, but the adjusted gross income plus half of the Social Security benefit plus any interest that was otherwise tax-free. And if that amount exceeds certain thresholds, then you have to start paying taxes on some of the Social Security benefits. And so doing those Roth conversions and delaying Social Security can also help set up opportunities to avoid having to pay taxes on Social Security benefits later on as well, because you can fill in any gaps in your spending needs from Roth distributions, and that does not show up on your tax form.
You know, you're a professor of retirement income at the American College. What would you say are some of the more daunting tasks facing retirees today as you studied the subject?
I think it's always the question of how much can you sustainably spend? When should you start Social Security? And I know a lot of people do worry about whether the government's going to cut Social Security, and should you buy income annuities? How are you going to cover long-term care expenses? Do you have a plan for that, or do you have insurance for that? What to do about your home? Do you want to stay in the same home, or do you want to downsize? And if you do stay in the same home, then you can think about, should you have a reverse mortgage on your home? And all these other issues. There's a lot that goes into building a retirement plan, and to just manage the different risks as well, the market volatility, the longevity, not knowing how long to plan for, inflation. With inflation over time, you can't just have everything in cash, or the real value of your assets will decline, and so forth. It's a challenge, but it's something that can be managed and overcome, especially working with a financial advisor or spending a lot of time to study the issues on your own.
You listed a statistic. We've been talking about delaying Social Security benefits here. If you went back to 2008, only 5% of the public was doing that. As of 2014, 11%. So more and more of this information and the benefits are getting out. Do you find that as more people, let's say, do more planning for their retirement, that they're finding out these benefits? Because I read the statistic, and you probably are more familiar with that statistic than I am, of how many Americans actually have a retirement plan as they head into retirement.
Fewer and fewer people have the defined benefit retirement pensions anymore. But right, it's true that since around 2008, there has been an uptick in people who delay their benefits past the full retirement age. At the same time, there's been a big drop in the number of people who claim at age 62 as early as they can. That was over 50% for years and years, and then it started dropping, and it's now under 40%. So I don't know exactly why that happened. I like to think part of it is this growing recognition and more discussion, more education that people are getting about that it's not necessarily a good idea to just claim Social Security as soon as you can. That's probably part of the reason. I don't know if there's other factors at work as well, of people just being forced to delay their retirements and so forth. But there's definitely a trend. People are starting to claim Social Security later than they always were over the last 30 years prior to around the 2008 era.
Do you think that's maybe more confidence that Social Security will be there? Because I know for the longest period of time, it was claim it at age 62 because it might not be there.
Yeah, for a long time, people have worried about this issue. I don't know if people are becoming more confident that it's going to be there or not. There might be some Gallup polls or things on that. I remember in the late 90s walking around Washington, D.C. when I was there one summer, and there were people who had a display about how more Americans believed that aliens had visited the Earth than who believed that Social Security will be there when they retire. And yeah, those concerns are overblown. And I don't know the trend, whether people have backed off of that and do start to recognize that Social Security will be there or not. Perhaps that education is getting out there as well.
Well, listen, Professor, as always, I want to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. If our listeners would like to follow your work and your blog and the things you write about retirement, how can they do so, please?
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I've written the website, retirementresearcher.com. It's all one word, retirementresearcher.com. And I blog and write frequently on different topics. I'm right now starting to write more about long-term care, and then after that, I'll probably have a series on reverse mortgages. So thanks a lot for that recognition.
Well, keep up the great work, and please come back and talk to us again.
Thanks. Yeah, I hope so. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Jim, I think one of the most important things that we could look at right now is the idea of getting in shape, and that there are actually ways to do this that aren't bad. And we're talking about, first of all, physical shape, because that affects your longevity, but also getting into shape financially. There's a series of things that people should do, and it needs to become part of your lifestyle. It's not something that is a, what I call a grunt thing that you have to do. I have to grunt and try to make this happen. It involves a gradual rework of your lifestyle, but it's really important. So we're going to make that the theme here on lifetime income this year.
Yeah, because, I mean, this is the time of the year where you make those New Year's resolutions. Okay, I'm going on a diet. I'm going to get to the gym, work off the extra pounds or the pounds gained over the holidays or whatever it is. But we always make those New Year's resolutions. And I think this is the year that I think financial resolutions should be made as well, because it's been proven over time, people that have a retirement plan have a much greater chance of having a nice retirement, not worrying about, let's say, outliving their assets than those that don't. It just makes sense. It's like going on a trip. You wouldn't go on a trip, a pilot wouldn't pilot a plane without GPS or a destination point. And you need to do the same thing when it comes to your own retirement. So we'll be talking more about that in the weeks ahead. A lot of good programs coming up as we hit more issues on health and finances this year. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.